in every country, Australia as much as the U.S., Australia even more, there's a constant recalculation of what China is up to as it gets more and more power. And I think in the United States, the driving factor above everything else is the chronically high unemployment rate. And I think the main thing that's changed recently is the U.S. is being able to array a number of other countries essentially on its side and saying that China is making it more difficult for any economy to rebalance itself with its undervalued RMB, yuan.
I would like to argue tonight that Australians should be worried about China's rise because it is likely to lead to an intense security competition between China and the United States with considerable potential for war. To put it bluntly, China cannot rise peacefully.
The message that's been coming out of America over the past year or so has been pretty clear. China is a threat. The country is getting under the skin of the world's only superpower. So says the BBC's man on the ground in Washington, Matt Fry, who recently wrote that the US was suffering what he termed status anxiety over a rising China. Hello, Anthony Fennell here. Welcome to Future Tense.
In a single generation, revolutions in technology have transformed the way we live, work, and do business. Today, just about any company can set up shop, hire workers, and sell their products wherever there's an internet connection. Meanwhile, nations like China and India realized that with some changes of their own, they could compete in this new world. And so they started educating their children earlier and longer, with greater emphasis on math and science. They're investing in research and new technologies. Just recently, China became the home to the world's largest private solar research facility and the world's fastest computer. So yes, the world has changed. The competition for jobs is real. But this shouldn't discourage us. It should challenge us. Remember, for all the hits we've taken these last few years, for all the naysayers predicting our decline, America still has the largest, most prosperous economy in the world.
Barack Obama's State of the Union call on Americans to, quote, win the future, shows just how concerned many of them are about China's growing stature in the 21st century. It's a significant political issue. And while a great deal of American anxiety could arguably be put down to simple insecurity, in the technology field, there are real signs that China is shaping up as a genuine rival to the US. Today, we'll focus on two specific areas, advances in battery technology and supercomputing, the latter of which was referenced, of course, in President Obama's speech. We're going to start with Thomas Hout. He's a fellow at the Centre for Emerging Market Enterprise at Tufts University in Massachusetts and a visiting professor at the University of Hong Kong School of Business. Now, we're used to thinking about China as the world's factory. But according to Professor Hout, it's the attempts China's now making to move beyond that phase into advanced technologies that's really got American businesses and officials looking over their shoulder. But here's the twist. Professor Hout argues that the Chinese government is pushing its business into the high-tech field, not just because it wants to match America, but because it has its own feelings of economic uncertainty and anxiety.
China has shipped a lot of goods over the last 15 to 20 years, but they haven't made much money. And the reason is because the brands and the technology behind most of these products were owned by foreign companies, and the products that the Chinese companies made were pretty ordinary commodity almost goods, where price was low and margins were very small. And looking forward, China sees that this business, which is now low profit, may disappear altogether because as their currency appreciates, and it hasn't yet, but it will certainly appreciate more in the future, they'll lose some of this business to other Asian countries. So I think they see this as pretty urgent to change their export mix away from these low profit margin commodity items.
So in a sense, they're looking at the experience of Western countries, I guess, in terms of our manufacturing closing down, our manufacturing moving to cheaper economies, and they're getting interested in the technological side of economic activity to avoid the problems that we in the West have had in the past.
Yes. In fact, the Chinese premier, Wen Jiabao, when he hears the Americans talk about the importance of revaluing the Chinese currency, the first thing he always says is that this will close thousands of factories in China and put tens of millions of people out of work. And they've seen it happen in the West. And China's domestic political situation is probably more volatile, potentially explosive than even ours. The Chinese people have bought into the idea that China is a growth machine and can employ 10 to 15 million more people every year as they come into the workforce. And if that job growth were suddenly reversed, given the kind of dubious legitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party anyway, the only legitimacy they have is to promote economic growth, I think it's possible that the Chinese domestic political peace could fall apart, and who knows what would happen.
So according to Thomas Hout, while China is on the rise, we shouldn't forget that it also has its own economic problems to deal with, a point many Americans seem to overlook. Now, one way in which the Chinese are trying to ensure a continuance of economic growth, according to Professor Hout, is by implementing new policies that deliberately seek to appropriate technology from foreign multinationals. But is that, I wonder, a direction that Chinese businesses are pursuing independently of Beijing, or are they under orders from the central government?
It's government-sponsored in that most of the big technology, high technology that China is seeking is for state-owned companies, and the architect of all this is Chinese government. And to some degree, there is acquisition of technology from the outside through espionage and so forth. But I think most of the technology that they're looking for and that they need is the technology that they're trying to co-opt from the Western multinationals as they invest in China.
And what sort of strategies are they using to co-opt that sort of technology?
They're using several means. One is to limit the content that can be imported by the multinationals. Historically, for the very advanced technology goods or components of goods, the Western or the Japanese companies would import half or more of it from their home bases, and then they'd use Chinese local production to put together the rest of the product. The Chinese have responded to this by saying you must perform 60 or 70% of the work on these products in China, which forces the multinational to bring the technology into China. And of course, they're concerned about this because intellectual property protection there is weak. So that's the first element. Second element is Chinese are requiring mandatory joint ventures, that is, the multinational must marry with a Chinese state-owned company in a number of industries, like fast rail, aviation, electric cars. And this is the way that they can engage the Western technology company with the local Chinese company and force the technology transfer. And thirdly, they are requiring, as a condition of these joint ventures, that up-to-date technology be transferred.
And so executives of multinational companies, they face a huge dilemma here, don't they? Because they can see the enormous money to be made from the massive Chinese market, but at the same time, they must realise that in meeting those demands, they're giving away the secrets of their own success. They're allowing the Chinese one day to be able to rival them in their own economies, in their own manufacturing sectors.
Yes, they do face that dilemma. And if a particular multinational chooses not to play, there are others that will. So they're dividing and conquering the multinationals. And the Western governments have not been particularly effective in fighting these new requirements.
So that's the plan, according to Professor Hout. But will it work?
It does remain to be seen how effective the Chinese state-owned companies will be in absorbing and copying the technology from the joint ventures. The Chinese idea here is for the state-owned joint venture partner to learn the technology from the Westerner and then apply it in their own parent company and hopefully become independent of the joint venture. That has not happened in the past. The Chinese tried this in the automobile industry in the 80s and the 90s, requiring Western auto companies to marry Chinese domestic auto producers. And the joint ventures became very strong and actually dominate the market, and the Chinese parents are generally left sitting on the outside. So my guess is that these joint ventures in China will become powerful companies in and of themselves. And just like in the automobile industry, they will dominate most of these industries. So we're going to have a hybrid industrial structure in China, where the Western and the Chinese companies are kind of married for a long time.
We applaud superpower economies, locked in a battle over monetary policy. For social stability, we got to export.
And we're sick of being the consumers of last resort. Times are tough in the USA. Listen up, fool, I got something to say. Help us out. You know what I'm talking about. The RMB's too low without a doubt.
Now, a satirical rap song that circulated on social networks during President Hu Jintao's recent visit to America. Now, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, supercomputing is one of the high-tech areas in which the Chinese now have a presence. But before we go much further, let's first get a clear idea about what a supercomputer actually is. Here's Jack Dongara from the Innovation Computing Laboratory at the University of Tennessee.
Supercomputer is one of the fastest computers we have today. By definition, that's going to change over time. At the moment, the fastest computer is a computer which does a great number of operations per second. We measure the speed in terms of what we call petaflops, 10 to the 15 floating point operations per second. So that's 1 times 10 to the 15, the 15 zeros after it, operations in 1 second. Just to give you a clue as to how that what that really means or what it's equivalent to, if every man, woman, and child on Earth were doing a calculation a second, that is, if I handed out paper and pencil to everybody in the world and asked them to do one calculation a second, it would take all of the population 290 years to do the same thing this computer can do in 1 second. So that's a supercomputer.
Now, when Chinese scientists announced late last year that they'd built a new computer that was faster than anything else on the planet, the news sent elements of the US media into a minor frenzy. It was treated as a blow to US prestige. America had lost yet another crown. But in truth, it wasn't the first time this had happened. Back in the early years of the century, the Japanese had also jumped ahead of the Americans by building a supercomputer, which at that stage was far more powerful than anything to be found in the US. So, hype aside, how important is this new Chinese advance? Professor Dongara is responsible for keeping the official list of the 500 fastest computers in the world. Here's his opinion.
Well, look at it like this. This isn't really a race in terms of who has the fastest computer. It's more a sign of who has the technology and who is willing to invest in a certain technology. So in the U.S., there's been a consistent investment. And what we've seen recently from the Chinese understand, back in the year 2001, had no supercomputers. That is, on this list of the 500 fastest computers, there were none that were in China. None. Today, they're making progress, they're investing, they're developing technology, and today China surpasses Japan in terms of the power of the supercomputers. In fact, China surpasses Germany, they surpass the UK, they surpass France and Germany in terms of supercomputing power. And if you look at the change that's taken place, Chinese supercomputing, it's on a path to really intersect with the US in the near future.
Is there anything unique about this new Chinese number one supercomputer?
Well, a supercomputer is made up of various components. There's the processors in the computer, there's the interconnect in the computer, and then there's the software which runs the computer. That's putting it very simply, but those are basically the three components that we talk about in this case. The Chinese computer is using Western processors. That is, it uses processors from Intel and a graphics company called NVIDIA. The graphics processors are used to accelerate floating point operations in this computer. And that's a standard trend today, using hybrid commodity processors plus graphics processors. The unique thing about the Chinese number one system is the interconnect. The interconnect was designed and built using Chinese parts. And this is really the first time we've seen China deploying this kind of technology in terms of high-performance computing. So that, in some sense, more than anything else, is the news about this computer. Not the fact that it's number one so much, the fact that they're using technology or components that were built and designed in China, where the processors are coming from the U.S., The interconnect, the thing which moves data from one process to another, is something the Chinese have designed.
Now, as I mentioned earlier, I mean, this seems to have been a bit of a blow for America's national pride, at least in terms of the way the media in the United States has portrayed this. But from somebody involved in computing, in terms of the computing community in the United States, is this really going to have any effect on the sort of work that people in the industry do in the United States?
No, I don't think it worries us in that sense. I think what some people are concerned about is the fact that Chinese are developing technology independent of Western technology. And, you know, from the Chinese standpoint, they must be concerned that the Western side may turn off the flow of technology into China for perhaps an arbitrary reason. And the Chinese want to protect themselves and are developing technology that can be used independently of Western technology. But furthermore, you have to understand that these computers really drive competitiveness in industry. That's something, I guess, that the U.S. must be concerned about. High-performance computers are used in various ways in industry, of course, and if you have a better supercomputer, you may be able to gain an edge on someone else building the similar kind of product. I mean, that's one reason why we see over 50% of the supercomputers in industry. They get it. They're deriving some benefit from these machines, and that benefit gives them competitiveness over their counterparts.
You're with Future Tense, new ideas, new approaches, new technologies. We're available as a podcast via iTunes and ABC Online, and our name on Twitter is RN Future Tense, all one word.
China has made a commitment to the development of advanced batteries and the creation of an electric car industry. It wants to control the global electric car industry, and it has announced plans, and it is in the process of rolling out 500,000 electric cars over the next 2 years. It literally can order up an industry. When you do that, you're instantaneously scaling up. You get the economies of scale over time, and the learning curve falls into your advantage.
If Steve Levine is right, one of the great economic and technological battles over coming decades will be fought out in the area of battery technology. Batteries haven't really changed much in decades, and it's the limitations of the lithium-ion battery which many people believe has prevented the car industry's move away from the combustion engine and all its related environmental problems. Mr. Levine is a contributing editor at the prestigious magazine Foreign Policy, and he talks of the great battery race, the quest to develop the next form of battery technology, a race which he says already involves many nations, South Korea and Japan, for example, but which will ultimately be dominated and defined by, you guessed it, the US-China rivalry.
Just to be clear here, we're not talking about something that's happening in the next 5 years. We're talking about a two-decade-long runway, the outcome of this race, of the advanced battery race, and the enabling technologies, which that's the enabling technology for other big products like electric cars. We're talking the big hit is the late 2020s and the 2030s. And so what are we talking about? Advanced batteries, when they really hit their stride, are going to be an industry the size of Exxon, of General Electric. This is going to be an economy-making industry, and electric cars, the projection is that you're going to have four or five companies the size of Exxon.
One of the points you make, picking up on that, is that the United States no longer has that sort of manufacturing base that it once had, that China now has, to support the development of advanced batteries.
That's right. So the United States is at a serious disadvantage. It's attempting to create some kind of a wedge in which it can compete in this field. Obama has put $2.4 billion into the creation of an advanced battery industry. But the U.S. is very late, and experts think that it's really got its work cut out for it. But this is where another idea comes into play, and that's that what can the United States do in order to get into this game in a big way? Well, who are the big players? We've already mentioned Japan, but there's also South Korea. South Korea is going very, very big into advanced batteries. It has a manufacturing base. it has established that learning curve. The detail that I'm leading to is that Obama, when he was handing out this $2.4 billion, the biggest single piece of it went not to an American advanced battery maker, but a Korean, LG. A South Korean company was given $400 million to establish an advanced battery plant near Detroit for the Chevy Volt. And the smart thinking that I'm hearing is that what the United States does is form a strategic partnership with South Korea. It brings South Korean companies into the United States, U.S. know-how, South Korean manufacturing, and suddenly you're in the game.
And I presume from a geopolitical perspective, I mean, South Korea and Japan would presumably be quite worried about the potential dominance of their near neighbour, of China, which would make an agreement with the United States much more palatable, wouldn't it?
It would. One of the interesting things of researching this story was going into the laboratories, the national laboratories, and talking to them about this very issue. They deal with China, they deal with South Korea, with Japan. The national labs in all of these countries do collaborate. They fear China, but I ask this question. If you are going to collaborate with one country, if a strategic partnership is going to be formed, with whom would that be formed? And what you get is, one, China is ruled out because of this strategic rivalry. China is not going to be the one. We're not going to team up. The United States is not going to team up with China. It turns out that the Japanese, when they're working with other countries in the lab, they're more takers than givers. They, as a rule, they want to collaborate up to a point, and at that point, they go home and make it themselves. The South Koreans are very collaborative, it turns out. South Koreans aren't trying to control everything. They simply want to come into your market and make the product. And so according to the labs, that's why I say South Korea is seen as being the ideal strategic partner.
Steve Levine. And if you want to read his recent article for Foreign Policy magazine entitled The Great Battery Race, simply go to our website and you'll find a link. Now, just before I said goodbye, I asked Mr. Levine a final question. Where did he place this great battery race in comparison to the other great geopolitical contests of the last century?
You can't compare it side by side with the Manhattan Project in the way that the Manhattan Project, when the scientists were developing this, this was regarded as life and death. The space race would probably be a better comparison in that this was geopolitics, this was mastery. There was a lot of symbolism in it, but it is more consequential than that too, because it's a proxy. The big race that we're talking about is who is going to rule the rest of the century? How are the economies of the world going to grow? And in a world in which a great economy adds up to great power, then again, who is going to be the great power? For example, is the United States going to just decline straight down and China, the juggernaut, go straight up? Or is it going? Will they be side by side? And so in this way of describing it, the Great Battery Race, very, very consequential. It's about great power. It's about China, about the United States, and dominance of the world.
And that was Steve Levine. Coming full circle now, and back to Professor Thomas Hout from Tufts University in Massachusetts and the University of Hong Kong School of Business. And a comparison of the sort of money being spent in China and the US on research and development. A bit of a pet theme for this program.
Historically, Chinese companies invested less than 1% of their turnover, their revenues, in R&D. American companies are around 2.5% on average, and of course some industries are very much higher. The Chinese are now trying to move that percentage up. I think it's currently about 1.6 or 1.8% in China, and their plan is over the next 20 years or so to get it up to the 2.5% that U.S. companies spend. There have been a lot of problems and disincentives for Chinese companies to put much money into R&D in the past. Number one, they didn't really need it because they were gaining production share simply on the basis of their cost advantage. And secondly, defense of intellectual property is difficult in China, and most Chinese companies didn't want to invent something and then just have it stolen. So as they feel the need now to develop more higher value-added goods and put more money into technology, the Chinese are beginning to get more serious about intellectual property protection.
Now, we often link innovation with research and development. As you mentioned earlier, a lot of the major companies in China are still state-owned. They're still very reliant on orders from the central authority. What sort of effect does that centralization, that heavy centralization, have on these companies in terms of innovation?
Central authority usually depresses innovation. And one of the reasons why I'm a little skeptical that there'll be a massive improvement in innovation in China. China has, in the state-owned sectors, the Chinese government has consolidated many players into two or three or four competitors. We call them oligopolies. And it's the Chinese hope that these companies will now be of a size and profitable enough that they'll be able to fund research which produces innovation. So this is an experiment. It's a state capitalism trying to bootstrap innovation. And it's a tall order, I think.
Thomas Hout from Tufts University in the United States and the University of Hong Kong. And also today, Jack Dongara from the Innovation Computing Laboratory at the University of Tennessee, and Steve Levine, a contributing editor for the magazine Foreign Policy. Now, last week, we took a look at the role of science fiction, and we're still keen to hear your thoughts. So send us a tweet or make a comment on our website. Just go to the Future Sci-Fi box on the right-hand side of our webpage. Does science fiction still have the influence it once had? What does it mean to you?
Hi, my name's Liam. I'm from Canberra, and my most influential or favourite piece of science fiction is actually Doctor Who, both old and new. I discovered it when I was little and lived in England, and I particularly discovered mostly the books because it wasn't actually on television when I was little. In terms of how it's influenced the future, I think because it was such a part of English culture and history, it exposed so many young people to science, including myself, but there are a lot of prominent scientists such as Richard Dawkins and Michael Moorcock, those sort of people that have put Doctor Who as, you know, part of their culture growing up and got them interested in science. So, I mean, Doctor Who often got the science very wrong, along with the budgets. But in terms of inspiring young people to get into science and be interested in science, it's such a cultural touchstone for people growing up in that time.
Hi, I'm Peter Anderson. I'm from Sydney, and I'm talking about Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. One of the things that amazes me about Hitchhiker's is the way it predicted so many things so accurately, like the sub-Ethernet being the wireless internet, or the internet really. Things like handheld devices like the Hitchhiker's Guide itself, which, while very clunky in the series and the book, really predates things like tablet computing, like the iPad, and even things like the iPhone. And the accuracy of that is quite impressive. And it's amazing how many of these devices you see around with "Don't Panic" written in large friendly letters on the screen or on the cover. And in a lot of ways, the prescience of what modern life has become, it's not the glamorous flying cars and things that the 60s sci-fi people described, but the Hitchhiker's universe is quite rusty and hulky and hitchhiking in funny old ships. And we're still moving around in much the same way as we did when Hitchhiker's came out, but we have these small things in our life, like these handheld devices, that have really changed our lives. And I think its influence in predicting and then having something to say about this modern handheld culture, that's just a tiny small thing for a professional and recreational geek like myself, has been something that always springs to mind when something new comes out. You think, oh, that was in Hitchhikers, that was in Hitchhikers. And that's not always something you can say about science fiction, which tends to try and outdo itself. And that's why thought Hitchhikers was so impressive.
So there we are. Let's hear from you. Send us a tweet or comment on our webpage.